Hello everyone, it's Helena here in Truro, here to talk about Caravaggio's Supper at Emmaus of 1601. As I mentioned in my introduction, this was commissioned by Ciriaco Mattei, the eldest of three wealthy and influential brothers, whose patronage and hospitality Caravaggio had been enjoying following his departure from the residence of his first principal patron, Cardinal Del Monte, early in 1601. The Supper at Emmaus was one of three paintings commissioned by Ciriaco, the other two being St. John the Baptist in the Wilderness and The Taking of Christ. The three works were painted over the course of some 2 years when Caravaggio was at the height of his success and fame. Before we look at the painting in detail, let's first consider the story. The Supper at Emmaus is a narrative that is told us in St. Luke's Gospel, chapter 24, verses 13 to 35. It recounts the dramatic first meeting of Christ with two of his followers after his death and resurrection. The story tells how two disciples, one Cleopas and the other not identified in the narrative, are walking to a village called Emmaus, some 7 miles or 11 kilometres away from Jerusalem. On their journey, they meet a traveller who in fact is Jesus, but they don't recognise him as such. The disciples have been busy talking about the astonishing events of the previous few days. How following the crucifixion and burial of Christ, his tomb has been found empty on the third day by some of the women who've gone to pay their final respects. The women claim to have seen a vision of men who appear to be angels, telling them that their Lord has risen from the dead. While their account has generally not been believed, the tomb is indeed empty, and the disciples simply do not know what to believe. But they do express their disappointment that Christ has failed to free them from their Roman oppressors, so they clearly see his mission on earth in political terms. They are surprised to discover that this stranger seems to have no knowledge of the amazing events under discussion. But they're even more astonished by the fact that the traveller does seem to have an understanding of Christ's purpose and mission on earth. Indeed, he even gently chastises them for failing to see that Christ's death and resurrection fulfills the prophecies of the Old Testament. And he goes on at some length to explain exactly how. When they arrive at Emmaus, it's clear to them that the traveller intends to continue on his journey. But they beg him to stay on the grounds that it's getting late. So they go into an inn to have a meal together. And it's when Christ blesses and breaks the bread on the table that they suddenly recognise who he is. Because those gestures trigger in their mind a remembrance of the Last Supper, when Christ broke bread and distributed wine to symbolise the breaking of his body and the shedding of his blood on the cross. And as soon as they recognise him, he vanishes from their sight. Now, when the disciples excitedly compare their reaction to what they have seen, they agree that when Christ was explaining how the scriptures were fulfilled on the road to Emmaus, they felt a burning like a fire inside their hearts, implying that their spiritual enlightenment as to the purpose and mission of Christ's life on earth and the true significance of the resurrection was a prelude to and a prerequisite for their visual, physical recognition of their Lord at supper. They then return to the remaining disciples to tell them the good news that their Lord has indeed risen from the dead. Now, before we take a look at Caravaggio's work in some detail, I'd like to invite you to consider Titian's work of the same subject, which was painted around 1530 to 1535 and hangs in the Louvre Museum in Paris. Now, I must emphasise, this is not intended to try and assess which of the two artists has produced a more powerful, convincing account of this gospel story. Nor is it intended to compare the respective merits of the two great artists. You may find yourself doing that, but it's not the purpose of this exercise. It is simply designed to illustrate why Caravaggio's art was seen as being so radically different compared with that by his contemporaries and predecessors. We take for granted the world of modern technology, cinema, photography, computer-generated images, which give us near-perfect images of the world in which we live. We have to try and imagine an age when there was only the medium of sculpture and painting to give a visual record of the real or imaginary world. Artists had been striving for many years to introduce greater realism and naturalism into their work through the use of perspective, for example, but that wasn't their only concern. Many Renaissance artists sought to present an enhanced, idealized version of the world, particularly when their subjects were stories from the Bible. It was right, they believed, to depict Christ in an idealized way, to emphasize his divinity and perfection as the Son of God. And even the disciples, the one-time fishermen and tax gatherers, would be given an artistic makeover in order to emphasize their divine appointment. And the Renaissance artist also wanted to give their viewer a completely satisfying visual experience. This could be achieved in a number of ways. For example, variety of composition, so the use of the human figure, animals, flora, fauna, landscape, and still life. They could enhance its aesthetic appeal through the skillful use of colour, tone, light, and shade. And by carefully considering the arrangements of the different elements in the painting, could achieve an overall harmonious effect, creating a sense of order, balance, symmetry, and proportion. All of these techniques, when added to the skillful draftsmanship of the artist and their ability to convey the drama of a scene and the emotions of the characters within it, would, it was hoped, leave the viewer with a rich and rewarding experience of the painting. And all of these considerations would no doubt have been very much in Titian's mind when he was planning his painting of the Supper at Emmaus. It's quite a large painting, 169 by 244 centimetres, and it's oil on canvas. The first thing to notice is that Titian gives us a very good overview of the whole scene. In the foreground is a large table, covered with a white tablecloth, with the folds clearly shown. Now, it is thought that Titian, in his depiction of the table, was inspired by Leonardo da Vinci's table in his Last Supper fresco in Milan. And that would make sense, because it's the memory trigger of the Last Supper that causes the disciples to recognise Christ at the Emmaus Supper. The table and cloth may remind us of an altarpiece, a deliberate reference to Christ's sacrifice, and also to Christ's inauguration of the first Mass or Holy Communion at the Last Supper, which was reinforced by his rituals of bread blessing and breaking at the supper at Emmaus. Christ is seated at the centre of the table, facing us, the focus of our attention. It's an idealised, reverential version of Christ. Very handsome, striking features. His face is part bathed in light, part darkened by shadow. The light we assume to come from the unseen sun, hidden behind the clouds. The sun that changes the colour of the leaves of the tree in the background from green to a burnished copper. But it's equally the spiritual light that illuminates Christ. The light that confirms his identity as the Son of God and proclaims the miracle of the resurrection. He is very beautifully, elegantly dressed. His white robe, the colours of the resurrection, appears pinky red in the light of the setting sun. And the beautiful blue cloak around his waist and shoulder matches the colour of the distant hills and sky. A reminder that while Christ is presently on earth, he will soon be returning to heaven. To the right of Christ stand the innkeeper and a serving boy, and in between them sits one of the disciples, dressed in green, who leans back in amazement at his recognition of Christ. It's thought that Titian based this dramatic gesture on the figure of Judas Iscariot in Leonardo's painting of the Last Supper. If you compare the two works, the similarities are clear. And the reason why the figure of Judas is so dramatic in Leonardo's painting is that the artist has chosen to depict in his painting the very moment after Christ has revealed to his company that one of their number will betray him. And so he's able to show all the disciples reacting in surprise to this shocking news. And as we'll see later on, Caravaggio was probably also inspired by Leonardo's painting in depicting the dramatic gesture of the unidentified disciple. But in his case, he was probably inspired by the figure of James the Greater rather than Judas Iscariot. And then to the left of Christ sits the other disciple, who is dressed in the robes of a friar or monk. Unlike his companion, and in an interesting contrast to him, he leans forward towards Christ intently, his hands clasped in prayer, suggesting that his recognition of Christ has been a more gradual process, but also possibly deeper and more emotional. The rich autumnal shades of the clothing worn by the innkeeper and serving boy and the two disciples, the browns, the golds, the greens, root them very much in the earth. Note how the brown robes of the disciple to our right-hand side seem to blend into the background, and the coffee-coloured scarf draped around his shoulders matches the tones of the leaves of the tree in the distance. And these earthly shades provide an interesting contrast with the more ethereal, pastely shades of Christ's garments. Christ does indeed appear to come from and belong to another world. It's a reflection of his divine status, his newly resurrected state, and his heaven-bound destination. So Titian presents us with the central elements of the story, together with a reflection on its deeper meaning. But he gives us much else beside. For example, there's a humorous subplot beneath the table. Have you noticed the dog and cat? Now, it has been suggested that the dog under the table may be a reference to a passage in Matthew's Gospel, chapter 15, where a non-Jewish woman tells Christ that even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall off their master's table, suggesting that Christ's mission extends beyond the Jewish community. But I'm not persuaded by this argument. And in any case, where does the cat come into all of this? Another suggestion is that the dog is a symbol of loyalty and trustworthiness, and the cat of cunning and deceit. But again, I don't find that very convincing. I think it only serves to start a potential argument between dog and cat lovers, so I don't think I'll pursue that idea any further. I honestly believe that it's Titian simply introducing an element of interest and humour into the painting. The dog has selected the very best spot to catch the crumbs as they fall under the table, and there's no way he's going to share his space with the cat. Then we're given a sense of the architecture of the building. A high wall to the left-hand side, then a column, then a low wall to the right-hand side, above which we have a beautiful view of the countryside beyond. And what a wonderful landscape we see. The verdant green fields, the hazy blue of the distant hills, some signs of housing to the right-hand side, the beautiful cloud formations behind which we can get an impression of the sun which bathes Christ's face in light, the majestic tree to the right-hand side of the column with its sun-dappled leaves, a tree, a symbol of Christ's sacrifice. And if it looks familiar to you, well, it's the same tree that featured, albeit on a larger scale, in Titian's painting Nolle Me Tangere, which showed Christ's appearance to Mary Magdalene outside the tomb after his resurrection. And I recorded a podcast on that painting, which I coupled with Bacchus and Ariadne for London Walks last year. There is a wonderful sense of order and balance to this picture. Everything is very easy on the eye. You have a contrast of the horizontals with the verticals. The horizontal of the table, the low wall, contrasted with the verticals of the high wall and the column. And the column and the table form the shape of a cross, a symbol of Christ's sacrifice. Christ is in the centre of the picture, the focus of our attention, but you could also draw an imaginary arch linking the heads of the disciples with Christ and reinforcing their position as the central characters in the story. With the exception of Christ wearing timeless biblical robes, Titian has updated the Bible story to his own times. The clothing of the other characters is contemporary to Titian's own period, and the landscape is of Italy, not the Holy Land. It could be argued that the inclusion of the dog and cat give a more modern flavour to the painting. And this is designed to reinforce the spiritual message of the story, that the gift of salvation, made possible by Christ's death and resurrection, is available to every person in every age and every place. Titian does not just present us with the Christ of history, he presents us with the Christ of the here and now. And yet, in spite of this contemporary flavour and the implication that the message of salvation is relevant today, there is still a sense of remoteness about the painting. There is a boundary between the picture plane and the viewer space which is acknowledged and accepted. We can view the world that Titian has created in his painting, but we can't get very close to it. We can't participate in it. By contrast, within that imaginary world he's created, through the use of perspective, distance and landscape, he's given his characters plenty of room in which they can freely move. For example, we can imagine the disciples, once Christ has vanished from their sight, rushing back through the fields excitedly, heading towards Jerusalem to tell their friends the great good news that their Lord is indeed risen from the dead. And ironically, the movement of the disciples away from us, running into the distance so they become more remote to us, represents the founding of the Christian church and the early missionary activity of the disciples in spreading the good news of the gospel throughout the world. So in summary, Titian has given us a good overview of the story, as well as its deeper spiritual significance. It's a real visual feast. So many pleasurable aspects to it. The beautiful use of colour. Titian's skilled draftsmanship, particularly in rendering the characters, their costumes and the cloud formations. The variety in the composition. The landscape. The sky, the clouds, the impression of the sun behind the clouds, and the subtle way he shows the colour-changing, shadow-casting properties of light, and the wonderful atmosphere of calm to this painting, created by the arrangement of the composition and the contrast between the horizontals and the verticals. It's a painting you want to spend time with, to take in all the beautiful details. And it also encourages you to meditate, to contemplate the deeper spiritual meanings of the story. And then we turn to Caravaggio's handling of the same subject. And the contrast is striking. For a start, although the painting is in fact smaller than Titian's, it's 141 by 196 centimetres, and like Titian's, it's oil on canvas. It appears much larger. And that's because the figures are bigger. In Caravaggio's painting, there's no landscape, there's no tree, no housing, no column, no architecture, no cat, no dog. There are simply the four characters in the story, Christ, the two disciples and the innkeeper, and the table, much smaller than Titian's, around which they're seated for supper. And Caravaggio has cropped the painting to show the figures in half-length form, so they appear to be as large as life. and as is characteristic of Caravaggio's religious works, he has chosen to depict the most dramatic moment in the story. The exact moment when the disciples recognize this stranger as Christ. Caravaggio wants that to be the main focus of our attention. In other words, Christ's revelation of his identity to the disciples and their reaction to it. So by picture cropping, he gives us close-ups of the disciples and Christ, so we can really see their expressions very clearly. And through his masterly use of light, he spotlights the gestures and expressions of the main protagonists, so we can focus our attention on their reactions even more. Now, you could argue that in Titian's painting, Christ is the centre of attention, but it's done in a much more subtle, less forceful way. You're permitted freely to wander around the painting and look at what you will. You could get completely distracted by the cat and dog. I certainly did. But Caravaggio doesn't give you that luxury. He makes it very clear what you should be looking at and why. He's not just a brilliant artist, he's a brilliant director. You could say he has all the skills of a film director, centuries before the medium of cinema was invented. And it's very difficult to look at this painting with an air of detachment. Caravaggio forces you to become involved. Because one of the major differences between this painting and that by Titian is all to do with that barrier, the boundary between the picture plane and the viewer's space. In Titian's painting, he respects that boundary, but he also gives, in that picture world, plenty of room for the characters to move around. In Caravaggio's painting, he rejects that boundary and reverses the Renaissance principle of providing space within the picture world through the use of perspective to give a sense of distance and by the provision of a background landscape to the painting. So whereas in Titian's painting, the disciples can run through the fields back to Jerusalem to tell their friends the good news of the resurrection, in Caravaggio's painting, if the disciples decide to do any running, they'll go straight into the tavern wall. And that tavern wall is, in theory, just a few feet away from where we're standing in front of the picture. That's how close we are, in theory, to Christ and this picture world that Caravaggio has created. Caravaggio doesn't want his characters to be comfortable in the world of the canvas, so he makes it a dark, shallow, claustrophobic space. There's no beautiful countryside they can escape to. They're blocked in by a wall, or in the case of other paintings such as The Taking of Christ, by a dark void. He crowds all his characters in front of these dark barriers. So they've got nowhere to go except towards us. Which they do when he brings them to life. Because they don't exist in the darkness. It's the light that gives them birth. The light that animates them. A light which in this, as in many paintings by Caravaggio, is a raking light coming from the top left-hand corner of the painting. And where that light, in reality, of course, the artist's paintbrush, touches the canvas, the characters he creates take on shape, volume, form, three dimension, as they spring out in sharp relief against their dark backgrounds. And they come forward like actors out of the darkness on a stage. Coming towards us, they invade our space. The barrier is broken between the world of the picture and the world of the viewer. The painting is finished in our space and by our presence. We are transformed from being spectators to being participants in the story. We are drawn into the painting, the characters come out towards us, there's a real sense of connection created between the viewer and the painting. Indeed, you could argue that all Caravaggio's works remain unfinished until the viewer is present, because it is their response to the painting which completes it. Well, hopefully, this comparison between Titian's work with that of Caravaggio will help explain why Caravaggio's work was seen as being so strikingly different by his contemporaries. And even more so when you bear in mind that his contemporaries would only have had the benefit of illumination by oil lamps and candlelight. So the figures would have stood out not only against their own dark background, but also against that of the surrounding space, particularly noticeable when the venue was a church. So they would have appeared to the viewer with an uncanny sense of presence and reality that we, in our electrically illuminated world, can only imagine. It's amazing when we consider how this chiaroscuro, the contrast between light and shade, can still astonish us today. How much more shocking it must have appeared to Caravaggio's contemporaries. Well, there's been a lot to take in so far, so it seems a good time to have a break. In section two of this talk, having looked at some of the general aspects of Caravaggio's painting, we'll be focusing on the painting in more detail. So looking forward to your company for section two of my podcast on Caravaggio's Supper at Emmaus. Speak to you soon.